Narratives in Philosophy podcast. In today's program, we're discussing Nietzsche and the revaluation of values. Also discussing Nietzsche the man and common misunderstandings of his persona. Anything to add to that?
That sounds about right. I'll be taking a little bit of a moral philosophy approach myself and some questioning, but
nice.
I like it. The episode is yours. I believe you had essay
ours. Indeed, I will be reading the audio essay titled The Descent of Nihilism on the Americas. Here we go. Nietzsche famously proclaimed over Europe, quote, "What I am now going to relate is the history of the next two centuries. I shall describe what will happen, what must necessarily happen, the triumph of nihilism," unquote. When Nietzsche spoke of Europe, he spoke of it as soon feeling the cold touch of nihilism with its darkness. In fact, he said, quote, "The whole of our culture in Europe has long been writhing in an agony of suspense, which increases from decade to decade, as if in expectation of a catastrophe, restless, violent, helter-skelter, like a torrent that will reach its bourne and refuses to reflect. Yea, that even dreads reflection," unquote. One feels a shiver come over their musculature at the thought of the awful events that occurred in Europe less than 50 years after the writing of what many consider Nietzsche's greatest work, The Will to Power. Writings compiled by his sister, Elizabeth Nietzsche. In the style of prophets from old, Nietzsche speaks as he would through Zarathustra in his most popular work. Quote, "Nihilism is the only possible outcome of our greatest values and ideals," unquote. With that declamation, he merely begins to tell the future. Today, Europe seems to all eyes torn apart by political infighting, overwhelmed by an amount of immigration it has never dreamt of, and questions the very fiber of what it means to be French, British, or German. Europe's problems aside, the obvious question remains, what of us? What of this hemisphere? Must we also have our day under the cold light of nihilism and disillusionment? For us, the answer also seems to be yes. With every crisis, the nation turns up the dial on the disillusionment. Regardless of our comparative unity after 9/11, it quickly fled away as the media tore apart our leaders for purportedly lying to the nation, accusing them of imperialism, continuing to dig the holes which had first been made in the era of Watergate. We began to ask ourselves, must war continue without abatement? Must the imperial legions always hold the forts in the hinterlands of Japan, South Korea, Germany, or any other myriad of locations in which they find themselves? Must life always be secured with the sword? Political questions aside, we continued to question, as we saw the power of our dollar unravel, as it proved unable to secure the privileges it once secured for our parents. We realized we lived in an era of slow but steady economic decline, a deepening of financial impotence in the middle class. Again, we questioned, must liberty always be bought dearly with money? Finally, even in our pursuit of happiness, we gave in to what Nietzsche called decadence, a sense of physical exhaustion and boredom with the simple pleasures of our parentage. That which gave us happiness continually became more overwrought, damaging to the faculties of the mind and expensive to the pocketbook. The good life looked less like the familial journey and the raising of children in simple joy, and more like continuous travel, endless spending on lines of credit, and artificial states of euphoria induced by various drugs. The pace of life continued at the helter-skelter rate mentioned by Nietzsche. We, too, were, quote, "writhing in agony of suspense, increasing from decade to decade as if in expectation of a catastrophe, restless, violent, helter-skelter, like a torrent that could not reach its bourne, which refused to reflect, that even dreads reflection," unquote. Then something unraveled, closer to the heart of the matter. When COVID-19 and all of its various problems fell upon us, we realized that we too had lost a sense of purpose. We too had given way to nihilism, The pundits and the folks who truly care about politics shriek in derision, loudly contradicting our statement, attempting to prove that they have found for us a worthy purpose. In fact, the only worthy purpose. The future decades will show whether they truly found such. The fabric of faith has been broken into 100 million separate shrouds, each equally certain of its primacy over every other cause or dedication. Our current situation looks something like Europe before the great wars of the 20th century. Only time will tell how we deal with the progression of our own ideals in the era of the devaluation of all values. So, that essay is attempting to show, well, what do you think? Maybe try to misunderstand me.
I could, it may not be so difficult to try, but, you know, when we think about what has been in the podcast, we've just had an episode, albeit somewhat more of a sidelights episode, but we just had an episode talking about truth, and even my own philosophizing of the topic resulted in a view of truth that was really grim. I mean, when it comes down to it, even in my formulation, you can't actually know truth. You have multiple degrees of separation. And this is something that really civilizations from the ancient times have acknowledged. The shroud of Isis or Isis, is a very similar theory to where you literally can't know truth because there's kind of a veil over reality. Going back before that, we talked about the things of empiricism and the philosophies which attempted to seek out, you know, proper formulations, things that were, for instance, about humanity, about the kind of anthropological question. And yet, we look at these theories and we can knock them right down because they're not sufficient. They're not sufficient sufficient models of reality.
Yeah.
We go back before that. And, you know, we're looking at the Renaissance, and frankly, the Renaissance was better than what was before that. And then we go back even older into the ancient times with the ancient, you know, philosophers, and what were their theories? They were jumbled messes of metaphysics and physics and ideas about the world. Oh, there's fundamental forces of fire and, like, what? Like, this is so far off the truth. And so we come up to the modern day, where we are with this essay. Back to Nietzsche, it's no wonder that we have nihilism. Because part of us as humans, it's so hard to contradict this, that we desire to know truth, that we desire to understand the workings of things. Maybe some of this comes, I mean, we've talked about this before, some of this probably comes from a utilitarian standpoint. We want to be able to work with the materials that we have and build better things in societies.
Yeah.
Some of it, I think, is deeper than that, more intrinsic than that. We take pleasure in thinking.
Yeah, there needs to be more delineation in that theory that you came up with, because obviously the data is, if they're like little gold mines, some of the gold is out of our reach, but it seems quite obvious that Western society since 1945 in some ways has succeeded. I mean, I'm sitting here with this amazing piece of machinery, this laptop created by Apple, with all of my notes organized, and that's just one of a million benefits that have proceeded to us. So that would be something that I agree with the theory.
Yeah.
In theory.
But
then
in practice it is
how,
a little bit more nuanced. Yeah.
What is the thought schematic for how we have plumbed that data gold mine and we've gotten some things from it, but some things still evade
right.
us? What is the line there?
I mean,
is there a delineation?
Is kind of fundamentally low level. So it is, you can build it up to a sort of higher level. My epistemology that I proposed was that first step, but then when I say act accordingly to the most, you know, likely of the of information that you have, which is built up from these observations or faculty reports, then, you know, above that level is where this sort of thing happens. It's like, well, what is really the most likely? What is actually? And so our minds tend to do that automatically for us.
Absolutely.
You know, it is very likely that there is a desk here, kind of like we talked about.
Yeah.
Very likely. So there's a lot of things that seem really obvious, and, you know, at a higher level of even language itself, we would say it's truly a desk here. Whereas in the theory, it's like, It's just but still talking at a lower level.
Certainty is impossible about the desk.
Yes.
Even though all data seems to lead us to believe it's a desk.
You know, I heard, take this for what you will, a quantum physicist once said, and I don't remember who, sorry.
No, that's good.
If you drop a coin on your desk, most of the time, it will clink and stay on the desk. It will hit the desk, bounce off, you know, stay there.
Yeah.
He said, theoretically, due to the uncertainty principle of quantum physics, now, in the real world, this would never happen, but theoretically, that coin could drop through all of the atoms in this desk due to the uncertainty principle. And I was just like, what? And I was really young at the time. I had no context for understanding this.
Wow.
It's the sort of statistical shenanigans that you kind of expect from some of the more flashy public speaking scientists.
Sure.
But at the same time, I think what he said is probably has some grain of truth there. It's just...
It's why you get
statistically
Heraclitus.
Statistically impossible. You know, that's another term we have that is, I think, helpful. It's statistically impossible. That's basically a good way of saying it's statistically...
will certain. Not happen. Probably will not happen.
In this case, it's statistically certain that there's a desk here, you know?
Yes. it's intriguing. So,
anyways, back to the
essay. Funny is, do you think, based upon the things we've kind of plumbed here, is there any reason for this pervasive nihilism to be such a thing? And also, I guess we should first decide, how do we ground this for people? And that's what this essay was trying to do, is take this out of these concerns of Europe 100 years ago.
Right.
Take this out of concerns of pre-Great War Europe, when all of Europe had you know, thrown off the shackles of the church, so to speak. The church had a unified jargon, a unified language in some way. It's almost literally, from up until Vatican II, Latin was the unified language, the unified system of thought, and a unified locus of power and control. That gradually is thrown off and supplanted by the nation state, and then you have all these people with their own truths going at it with each other.
Yeah.
But that doesn't really make sense to people. What we can do, though, is perhaps bring it home to here
in
America,
our... In the current day, in the current summer of 2020...
In the Northern Hemisphere, what can we say about nihilism and what it looks like? I've already spoken my piece towards that.
Yeah.
I see people shouting at each other, sometimes literally.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the pace of life was so fast, and we didn't realize this until many of us got thrown on our butts by COVID-19 and had to take time to slow down. We realized that, wow, life has been moving so fast, and when I take time to actually look at things, things don't look as well put together as I thought they were. So could you speak to that? Nihilism in the Americas.
So yes, when it comes to thinking about nihilism in our modern context, in our current day, what that looks like, there's a plethora of information when it comes down to it. We have really just symptoms coming up. We have depression. I'll tell you a story, in fact, a bit of anecdotal, but I was really quite young. I was 14 years old, on the internet as a 14-year-old would be in our growing up.
It's a place to be.
Talking with people, playing games, you know, having a good time, and making friends. And one of these friends was attracted to me because I was a positive influence in his life. I think I was the only positive influence in his life. And he would regularly tell me about cutting or tell me about various self-harm things that he did. And, you know, as young sheltered me, you know, I think I processed it better than I probably should have. But when it comes down to it, like, that was the norm for a lot of the people I interacted with.
Still
and
is.
I think that's the norm for the world right now. And it's medicated, you know? It's covered up, it's bandaged, but that's there deeply ingrained in a large majority of the population. Like, I really think it's a majority. I think it's actually a large majority that
ethos, that inner thought of just nihilism is the pervasive motif of their lives.
So they feel no sense of purpose. You know, how do we define nihilism? Because I think it's somewhat connected to our epistemology. It's somewhat connected to our...
I like that you brought up the authority of the church in old days. Because at least what I see maybe as what has gone on here, you know how I talked about the history of thought and philosophy moving forward, very rough sketch of how each age has sort of had a rough view of the truth and had a failing view of the truth. Hmm. What we have in the more modern day, in the 1800s, 1900s, and now 2000s, is the authority figures proclaiming that they have it all figured out, proclaiming that they understand the fundamental workings of the world. For instance, the Big Bang Theory is a wonderful example. It's like, this is the truth. Here is the truth about the creation of the universe. Aren't we great people? We figured it out. Mm-hmm. And then you go a little deeper into questioning about this Big Bang Theory. Where did it come from? And you get more details about the Big Bang Theory. And,
it's not going beyond itself.
Then you get people start talking about things like the simulation theory. And it's like, so you're admitting that there's effectively deities that created this universe.
This simulation.
Of a universe.
Because if they're able to do
that. And they just
go
berserk because it's like, no, we're atheist scientists. We would never. And it's like, you just talked about the simulation theory. What do you mean that there's not something beyond us?
If someone is able to create a simulation of this vast complexity and this felt realness,
that is more,
I don't care if they're a lizard person, you should bow down and worship
them. That is more deistic. That is more of a deity than most of the ancient gods in a pantheon. Like, frankly, that is way more power than what we traditionally have called deity.
Yeah. Zeus is just, throwing thunderbolts and sleeping with human women.
I mean, that's pathetic compared to someone who can simulate a universe. Pathetic.
That's good.
Zeus. So, where a part of this loss for direction is coming from, I think is from the thought authorities, the people in this world who have the... agreed upon authority to think for us.
And that was something that Nietzsche spoke to. He said that the Christian ethic gave people, especially Europeans, an instinct for something called truth. Whether it was actually certainty or faith, we don't really know. But it gave them an instinct towards knowing things. You know, that famous quote, humans by nature desire to know.
Right.
That's a European quote. And Nietzsche argued the source of that kind of thought process was in the Christian ethic. So he goes on and he claims that there is assumptions.
That's very interesting if that's really what he asserted, because that's closely linked to what I was saying before about humans desiring to kind of want to know how things work.
Yeah.
If he said that that's bound up in Christian ethic, then no wonder he was a creature of nihilism.
Because he saw Christianity falling into disrepair around him.
Yeah.
And we see that here, our old evangelical institutions, some evangelical leaders, as we've seen recently, completely making a wreck of their situation. And that begins to make people question, okay, this is how I, whether I knew it or not, decided what was true.
Yeah.
And now that is questionable. Just like many people question church.
Right.
Like going to a building. What happens when something that was your foundation for deciding your truth questions gets taken away? So Nietzsche observed that, but he also believed, and then it gets worse, that this affected the sciences. And he said that you can't do science without the Christian truth instinct.
Wow.
Now, of course, this is me interpreting Nietzsche heavily.
Okay.
I've read every book he ever wrote, except Untimely Meditations, I believe is the name of the one that I haven't read. And that was like one of his earliest ones. So I haven't read that one, but from what I've seen, he then goes on and says, values formed from the Christian ethic, we try to use science from the Christian perspective without knowing it, that somehow we can plumb nature and find out an eternal variable.
Yeah.
And all of this is nihilistic because it's founded on an assumption that there must be a deity behind the curtain pulling the strings. So those are some of his assumptions that he sees in Western thought. Are there any I've missed? Because there might be.
Well, I mean, I think it's interesting that he's effectively admitting to Christianity being an answer out of nihilism. Because that's part of where I wanted to go with this conversation is, you know, is this Imago Dei concept an answer for nihilism? What is really the answer in our modern context? Mm-hmm. You know, what is the minimum amount of ideas that we need to reclaim in order to combat nihilism? That's where I wanted to go. But it seems like he's proposing the answer right there for us. The problem is Christianity itself has its own problems to the extent that it disintegrates in his day and in our day and in all days. And so you get the nihilism almost as a result of the disintegration, not as some sort of rejection, or it's almost a necessary thing. Like there's no option. You know,
the only thing that he says is an option is it's possible for us to stay there and not form our own values for a very long time. And that's obviously something he was scared of.
Right.
So another assumption he points out is that it's an assumption to say science and logic can render the existence of any deity logical or necessary. Because again, he's saying what we call logic, that was filtered from the Aristotelian mode through this scholasticism, our entire process of thought, the way we think, has been handed to us by a church that dominated Europe for over 1,000 years. So what he's saying is that that is literally a thought matrix or a thought schematic that forms the things that we conclude must be necessarily so. So he doesn't even trust thought at a certain point because logic itself has been handed to us by the church.
That one's kind of dubious, I think. There have been numerous conversations about fundamentals in thought and mathematics, and how if you were to meet an alien civilization who had grown up completely separately from you, how you could communicate with them through math and symbols, and how you might even use the fundamentals of thought, basically,
to begin that
interaction.
I would totally agree with that, but
fundamentals there, then there's fundamentals. It's not something that's handed down from some church.
It's not the kind of fundamental that, like, let's just use your schematic here. That's just data. No language can function on that low, super low level of just being data. So if I use an equation to communicate with an alien civilization from the Andromeda Galaxy, I'm only going to be able to say so much because that's all I've got. But that aside, you know, what Nietzsche's saying is interesting because it renders our mind's truth-seeking ethic to go back and attack themselves.
Yeah.
So now our minds have been looking at the universe for hundreds of years, you know, doing science, doing the Baconian method.
Right.
And then we take that skill that we've acquired, and we're like, what happens if I turn it inward?
Yeah.
And Nietzsche did that.
It's a bit postmodernist, really.
He claims that he doesn't like what he found.
Yeah.
So those are assumptions he points out.
Okay.
And I don't know what else there might be, but, you know, it's just, you could just imagine that. Like, have you ever had a time where you've taken your truth-seeking instinct and just turned it on yourself? I mean, I know I have. When I've done it, I always find something I don't like. But there are also assumptions in Nietzschean thought. Perhaps you could speak to some of those. I have some, but I'm sure there are.
Yeah, perhaps. One thing that comes to mind in Thus Spoke Zarathustra, which is really the only work of his that I've read, he uses the character of Zarathustra, which is weird for him. He doesn't use a character in any other book. And one of the things he really rails against through this character is the equality or equity, the preachers of equality, and on he goes about how terrible that is and all of that. And I kind of, I'm still a bit confused about that point, because it's almost a common rallying point, because a lot of, in the current day, a lot of individuals rail against that as well.
Yeah.
And a lot of individuals are very, very pro that and for that and all of that. So I don't know quite where Christians typically fall on that spectrum. I think it's a mix. But regardless, perhaps you could speak to why. I mean, I know he was trying to build up the Ubermensch and all of that, but
that's really what's so interesting about Nietzsche, is he still has this Germanic sense of wanting there to be something
above,
to dedicate himself to.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Something dominating.
And for that, for him, it is the Ubermensch.
So,
for sure.
That is an assumption, then. It's an intrinsic assumption, basically, that a society would be better off, more progressive, if it has individuals who are above, who are dominating, who are ruling. Mm-hmm. Whereas there could be a different assumption there, that a society progresses only in so much as that equity is reciprocated.
Yeah, and he doesn't like equity at all. I mean, he has different moralities for different people. He has moralities for slaves,
yeah,
moralities for masters, and the value that he attempts to put in there as the thing that balances the equation, like we said, is the Ubermensch. And the hope is that through allowing the decadent to be decadent to the point of death,
yeah,
and allowing the slaves to do what they're supposed to do, which is serve, and allowing for the masters to do what they're supposed to do, which is rule, then things will naturally, he believes, work towards the Ubermensch. He doesn't paint much of a picture as to what the society of the Ubermensch will look like. And you know, that's,
right,
that's what's so interesting, is this is so divorced from political theory, from a Machiavellian political schematic.
It's almost a return to Aristotle's Republic, in a way.
Yeah.
Because he's like saying, okay, there's these systems of individuals, there's these groups, and each of them have to act in these ways, and it will be good.
No, I've never noticed that.
Yeah.
So it's almost like he's taking the Platonic Republic and painting a picture.
Platonic, yeah, sorry, not Aristotelian.
Yeah, taking a picture of it and just saying, this is what this actually looks like. Now, he's not being ironic. He's not being satirical. But
right,
it's almost like a satire of Plato's Republic. I did not realize that. But see, what he would say is, Plato's Republic, all that stratification, that's naturally here anyway.
Yeah.
So trying to make it not what it is, and all of this is heavily interpreted. I wish I had more quotes that could prove to you that this is what he seems to be saying. But what I've seen is that that's what he's saying. This is the way it is. Human societies are stratified. They're stratified. There are weaker people and there are stronger people. And our society is not good because we've put them all on the same playing field. So, other assumptions in his thought, though. One of his assumptions is that human actions and human words lack purpose and become sickeningly useless whenever the common variable between people disappears.
Okay.
So he's not saying that the disappearing of a common variable is good. He comes up with a replacement. But what's so funny is the replacement looks something like John the Baptist foretelling the arrival of Christ. And that was something I made a point of in that one video.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
that probably got us a few dislikes on YouTube. But it's the same kind of trope of this John the Baptist figure saying, I tell you of the Ubermensch.
I mean, I think that's a fair,
yeah,
analogy. It certainly seems to be what Zarathustra is doing.
It's definitely a clickbait thing. I've even put that on the cover of the video. John,
yeah,
the Baptist equals Zarathustra.
So in relation to the I guess, devaluing of words, how does this go back to the topic of the great man and his words sort of conversation? Because I think we,
yeah,
pretty strongly disagree with that. I think that words, as we've shown through narrative, through rhetoric and persuasion, really do have a lot of purpose.
Yeah, they do have purpose, but the sad thing is that it's purpose as you wield them.
Yeah.
You know, it's not the dictionary that I pull out, throw on the table, and say, oh, this means this, so you should believe this.
Right.
And that goes back to your truth schematic, which is that, you know, there's a data point there. I can get kind of close to it,
mm-hmm.
but it's also very possible for me to influence people in a direction that might be more based upon what I want and not what the data is saying on a probability level. The data says this, but I can use the narrative structure to bend someone in this direction. So he would say, yeah, the Christian ethic defined words literally. Like literally, Aquinas is sitting down and writing from the time he's 17,
yeah.
trying to argue and prove and give a reason for literally everything.
Yeah.
So that way everything has a literal meaning and
right.
no one can question it, but who knows it? Only Aquinas. And even he doesn't really know it very much. So he's saying that when that disappears, all of a sudden words themselves don't have the grounding stone that they need.
I could see that.
And then narrative.
That's something more I would agree with, really.
Yeah.
Yeah, like we've talked about.
Yeah.
The way the culture uses words is separate from what we like to think is, you know, words have absolute meanings as shown
yeah.
in the dictionary.
Now, you have to make a line in your brain, though, because then the question is, do you do what Nietzsche says and say, okay, the only absolute variable is what we make it to be because narrative functions in this manner? Or do we say, there is a logos, there is a structure, it's very difficult to know.
Yeah.
The data about that logos are very suspect, but it is possible to get closer to it. You know, I see two paths there.
Yeah. Okay, so taking it back to this truth structure, when I talk about words very briefly when I do, I'm saying that in communicating, let's say I'm talking to you right now, and you're receiving my words as data. They come with the inflection that you're receiving it moment to moment, and it correlates into a big information, goes into your brain. It's stored with context, it's stored with all this different stuff that brings what we traditionally call meaning. So here, I almost want to say something along the lines of a correspondence theory to truth. What I'm saying, if it corresponds to reality, has more value than if it doesn't correspond to reality.
So we would take...
You know, is more in accordance with truth. The
yeah.
problem is, I don't agree with the correspondence theory.
So it's a bit of a toss-up. I want to go to this higher level of language where correspondence theory would kind of be useful.
Mm-hmm.
And I almost say that in that essay, I almost say, like, it's just at a higher level about extraction. You know, it makes some sense up there. But anyways...
So you would take the course that is not Nietzsche's, because Nietzsche claims, okay, hey, values are being revalued, and
yeah.
you, if you are an Übermensch, you get to revalue them and decide what they are. And if you're not, then too bad for you.
Let's think about it like this. Would Nietzsche admit to a real reality?
The reality is only real as the Übermensch
See,
makes
so
it.
He's not really grounded. Like I tried to ground my truth, metaphysics truth theory.
Okay. So
because,
you do feel there is a grounded, something is grounded.
Oh, absolutely. Because
yeah.
in my theory, I'm admitting of a real reality. See, that's kind of the fundamental difference between mine and several other theories.
Because Heraclitus, Nietzsche, a lot of the classical thoughts, the pre-Socratics, Nietzsche's in there with the pre-Socratics. Like,
okay.
That Heraclitean quote, when you step into a river, you can't step into it twice.
Yeah.
It's always in flux. It's never the real reality more
okay.
than once. You know?
That is a big difference, then.
So see, okay, so Nietzsche is very much in the, you step into the river, reality is shifting.
Gotcha.
We're in the, still very much in the grounded Christian ethic, even though it is put scientifically.
There is a real reality,
yeah.
regardless of what we can or can't know about it. That's
okay.
what I'm saying.
Yeah, and that is a great way to demonstrate what Nietzsche thinks in a very poetic Grecian quote, you know, you step into the same river and it's different every single time.
Right.
So, because he even admits that there are some Christians that were forerunners of the Übermensch. Somebody he loves, Cesare Borgia.
Okay.
The military arm of the Pope Alexander VI, I believe it was. He loved Cesare. Because Cesare still owned up to his Christianity, but then lived like a man. And he thought that was amazing. But,
yeah.
you know, then there's the fact that Cesare probably had sex with his sister and all these things that, you know, it's like, ah. So we look at that and like, yeah, this guy's a terrible human being.
Right.
But Nietzsche looks at him and is like, yeah, look at that. That's a powerful man. That's an Ubermensch. He did what he wanted to do, but he was able to make it work in the Christian ethic. But he says the Christian ethic is getting to the point where nobody can do that anymore.
Yeah.
Because it's become so solidified. So that's one thing that's interesting. What values does Nietzsche believe must be revalued? I think the first one that comes to mind is the Christian morality.
Yeah, I mean, there's Christian morality, but you could go back older than that and say virtue in general. He doesn't see a use for that. That is not a concept for all men to...
Only the noblemen. You know, the noblemen can have their virtue.
You know, when Socrates taught virtue, when the ancient Grecians taught virtue, it was something literally for every single person.
Yeah.
That was the ideal goal for everyone.
Justice.
Now we have this fragmenting from the Nietzschean view. Well, you know, some people maybe need to have some sense of that, but most people don't.
And you can see why this guy kind of began to fall apart mentally. You know, yes, he had health problems. Yes, he probably got syphilis. And that probably really did some damage. But you see how his foundation isn't there. His brain is kind of a reed floating in the wind. And what he props up as his ethic looks something like a Jesus figure.
Yeah.
Now, yes, he hated the Gospels. He says, whenever you read the Gospels, you better be sure to have your gloves on, because it'll make you get dirty.
Wow.
That's what he thought about it. But still, he points out Jesus as somebody who used his power instincts to influence people and gain power in a way that is in line with what he thinks the Ubermensch should do.
Okay, so that kind of brings us to another thing we've talked about, which is the great man theory of history.
Yeah.
We talked about how each person has an amount of influence, and perhaps even if it's measurable, then you would have a distribution of influence. I proposed a Zipfian distribution. It could be something else for sure. And we mentioned Jesus would probably be that number one figure, given at least our context and perspective of the last 2,000 years.
Yeah, we calendar on the basis of his life.
Among many other influential things in our society, on and on. So if he does look at the Gospels and look at Jesus as a powerful figure, you know, someone who is living according to a Nietzschean ethic, I mean, is that what you were getting at? Because I don't necessarily see that, but...
I mean, that's the thing. Nietzsche will write one thing one place and another thing another place, and you take your proof text, and
I've
like,
kind of noticed that.
I'm going to do my proof text of Nietzsche. All
right, then.
And construct a theology of Nietzsche, and I've tried to do that, and I'm trying to do that.
What would he think of the Great Man Theory in general, is my question.
I think Carlyle and Nietzsche would be buddies,
yeah,
to some extent. He hates British utilitarianism. Carlyle also speaks against utilitarianism whenever he talks about the time,
yeah,
crying out for the great man to come.
Right.
And then a great man is nowhere to be found. So it's not based upon the utilitarian need of the time. The time isn't going to call out the great man. Nietzsche thinks the same thing. The great men must become who they are. And that will require sacrifice. That's the thing, though. All of this, is Nietzsche successful at revaluing any of our values? That's the thing. I feel like he just puts a Germanic...
He kind of just puts the nihilism on top and then tries to structure some things, but what really stuck beyond nihilism from his writing? I mean, I know he's literally read in colleges everywhere, but, like, what are we getting from him, really?
We're not really getting a revalued society. I mean, some people try to make the argument that, fascist societies are founded on Nietzschean principles.
I've heard that.
But Nietzsche hated the German race. When he wrote about them, he described them as disgusting, unhealthy. There's a great Stephen Hicks podcast, you know, that I'm going to reference as my work cited, where he reads a quote of Nietzsche, and I remember reading these quotes. Nietzsche hates the Germans. He thinks they are beer-drinking slobs. You know, not intellectually vigorous at all. And that's why he says at the beginning of the Will to Power, I wish this book had been written in French.
Mm.
Which is an iconoclastic thing for a German person to say in that
time
period.
Absolutely, yeah.
That's like around the Franco-Prussian War, right after.
It's just such an insult at that. Yeah, I mean, that's...
You know, they're forming the Schlieffen Plan, where they put down to the minute the railroad route of where their armies will go in the invasion of through Belgium.
Yeah.
So they hate the French, and then Nietzsche is saying that he wants it to be written in French because he likes their way of thinking better than the German way of thinking.
Wow. I'm thinking of a weird parallel here for any of the geeks out there. It's in a D&D world, this would be like a human author saying, I wish this were written in Infernal. You know, the language of curses itself, basically. I like their way better than ours.
Oh, man. And yeah, they're completely different from each other there. But what's interesting to me is how Nietzsche's thought has seeped into Christian circles, scientific circles, and we almost feel apologetic now about taking something at face value for what it is. Something that comes up to mind right away is the new perspectives on Paul in theological circles.
Yeah.
Like, we don't take things in textual criticism
at the
level
of
what it should be, in my opinion.
Historically,
we just try to go beyond
textual criticism has its roots pre-Nietzsche, if I'm not mistaken. So
I think it's 1840s German, a little bit further back.
There is some of that. I guess... Yeah, there is some correlation there. I just don't know that there's enough of an obvious connection that we could say,
sure,
you know, it stems from that.
But the question behind that
is
definitely there, that, you know, how can I know this is true?
Right.
How can I accept any of my texts?
Yeah, there's a lot of that.
Even one that's been copied 7,000 times with very little variance. So that's our question. Nietzsche has never been applied to society. People claim the Third Reich is an application. So if we had to play a game here of building a society based upon Nietzschean values, what would it look like?
And would it look like the Third Reich? It's hard to say. I mean, you do see these kind of wild, powerful leader figures as sort of Übermensch, but at the same time, they lose in the case of the Third Reich.
They seem to lose again and again.
And they don't... They're not, like, popularly accepted on that global scheme either.
Yeah.
If you know what I mean. And so I feel like a real Übermensch would be almost like a biblical antichrist, where they unite with peace, where they really do have that popular public support.
They use the narrative, master narrative structure
in
a way that applies to tons of people.
That is truly that's how you really win. That's how you really are over humanity.
Because, you know, Hitler's just like, oh, kill the Jews, kill the Slavs, kill the people whose gene pool is messed up. It's like,
I mean, you know, in a way, he's trying to go towards an Übermensch and an Übermensch society, but I don't...
But Nietzsche would never have...
That's not...
propagated artificial natural selection.
Right.
You know, he's like, things will take care of themselves. You know, if people are weak, they will die if we stop propping them up.
Yeah.
But I never see him talking about genetic cleansing or genocidal action. I never see him.
So I kind of do reject that idea of the Third Reich being a kind of Übermensch society. It's a good question. What would it look like? You know, honestly,
something
I just
like
go back to it. I think maybe the biblical account of...
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think it's anarchy either. I really
it's
think...
not anarchy, yeah.
I really think it is a cooperation-based society.
Hmm.
Maybe I'm wrong.
Interesting.
But...
So you're saying it's possible to have a very high level of structure and organization in this kind of society.
Okay, so for instance, I used to argue from the standpoint of evolutionary theorists, and where, you know, Christians would come and say, oh, you know, if natural selection and all of that's true, then we wouldn't have society. And I'd be like, no. Obviously, humans are smart enough to recognize that we get ahead by cooperating.
Hmm.
I used to argue from that perspective. It's a very simple perspective, but it kind of... Anyways, that's where I'm coming from, basically saying, if the Übermensch's goal is to progress humanity to a ubermensch state, where lots of ubermensch exist, then you need cooperation. You need highly structured societies, yeah.
And that's... At this point, we're now going off the page. We've probably been doing this a lot, and I'm glad we're going off the page because it's so easy to, like, find something Nietzsche says. It's like, oh, you're misrepresenting him. Okay, well, now let's leave Nietzsche aside and actually look at this. A off-the-page society with a lot of structure. I almost wonder if it looks something like our society right now, where everybody is a wheel in a cog.
That's interesting.
There's a corporate person.
It could be an idealized form of capitalist society, yeah.
That's why Ayn Rand, you know, was such a
right.
amazing capitalist, possibly.
Yeah.
I don't know, but now we're getting into the real off-the-page thought. But think about it. All of this is a machine. You get in your car, if you're working in the society, you have the same commute every single day. You fulfill your purpose, and that thing serves another purpose, and that thing serves another purpose.
Right.
So if you were to do almost an Aquinas domino analysis of everything, the question would be, where does it terminate? Is there a terminus, or is it self-propagating? This now gets into economic theory.
It seems to be self-propagating. But
yeah.
Maybe it's not quite as black and white as that. So, yeah. I had another question that's very closely related to this concerning the Ubermensch. I mean, the baseline question is, does Nietzsche really want many Ubermensch? Or one? Does he want a society which increases or individuals?
That is a tough question.
Is it better for two individuals to be at level 9 or one individual to be at level 10?
And then there's another question onto that. Can you really be at level 10 if there's not a million people at level 1 to compare yourself to?
Yeah, that's true too. I mean, Uber is sort of above or beyond,
so
right?
It assumes
so
that there is
a something. Relativity to that.
Yeah, so see, that's the thing, is sometimes it looks like he would love it if the Ubermensch was one of the last dudes on Earth, you know, and he has his harem or whatever.
Yeah.
But then other times you begin to really think it through and you're like, well, wait a minute, does this even make any sense if he's just one solitary dude and he's propagating a new race?
Yeah.
So I think there need to be...
So you know?
In his system, I would think logically he wants there to be an entire race of individuals who are of this high caste.
Okay. That kind of goes in alignment with what I was thinking as well. So I applied kind of a Kantian moral imperative to the idea of developing Ubermensch. So for those who maybe aren't too familiar, a categorical imperative, not moral imperative, but anyways, one of the formulations there is act only in accordance with that maxim through which you can at the same time, will that it become a universal law. So in simple terms, that means if you're going to do something, you should will it that everyone is able to do that thing.
Nice.
So I was wondering about, when this comes to Ubermensch, if you want an Ubermensch, if you want to become an Ubermensch, from a categorical imperative point of view, that is immoral unless you will that all people can become Ubermensch.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, I mean, Nietzsche might hate Kant's theory, but
he hates Kant. He made fun of him taking walks at the same time every day.
Oh, wow.
And he says that's a symptom of a constipated intellect as well.
Oh, dear. that's good commentary right there, yeah.
Okay, but, you know, there's no logic in that. It's just Nietzsche being
But I'm just wondering,
warm.
You know, wondering what's...
A categorical imperative, it's not good unless you want everybody to have the same good.
Yeah, and the way I had it taught, and I'm sure this was a very kind of undergrad level example, but if you steal a pen from your office, it doesn't seem like a big deal, right? Like, you took a pen home, you use it, now it's at home, you use it to sign your checks and stuff at home. Not a big deal. Your office will buy more. You're an employee there. Like, they pay you. It's fine.
Yeah.
What if every single employee always stole pens from the office? Then you have a real, real problem.
There's a pen shortage.
There's a serious problem. Because now, you know, you see the point there with the categorical imperative. You can't will it that everybody steals a pen. And since you can't will it that everyone steals a pin, you shouldn't steal a pin, you know?
That's the thing. The Übermensch, you know, seeks his self-interest.
He's that sort of natural selection champion. You know?
Natural selection champion. I love that term.
He's putting everyone else down in order to get up.
That's good. Okay, so could you will that everyone seeks their self-interest with such intensity? And this goes back to our earlier question. That's what our society looks like. So it's almost like... Because everybody has their group ideology, right?
Yeah.
Everybody has increasingly fractured and individualistic group ideologies, and everyone seeks their own interest, and it almost creates this world where everyone's trying to become an Übermensch and school everybody else.
The American dream, right?
Oh, man.
All right, but let's get down to some concrete things here.
This is good.
Kant's categorical imperative is specifying a maxim.
Okay.
Which is kind of a specific thing.
Yeah.
I couldn't figure out ahead of time exactly what I would say Nietzsche's maxim is when it comes
to
the
self-interest is what it looks like.
Really?
Yeah.
If that's really what it is, then we might have a problem with the categorical imperative test. Because, yeah, everyone's seeking their own self-interest. I mean, to the extent that we can say, oh, that's our society right now, okay, maybe. But what wouldn't we have in our society if it were the case that everyone was absolutely seeking their own interest? What would be missing?
Ooh, try to say that question another way, just for me.
In our own society, if everyone were seeking their own interest, who wouldn't exist? You know, for one thing that comes to mind, there's a sort of...
That's a good question.
Sect. It is a really interesting question, I think. There's a sort of sect of clergy, religious men, preachers, teachers, who forgo high-paying jobs from their former lives. They forgo the undergraduate and even above-level technical degrees that they have and jobs they can get with that in order to take less pay but help people. Teach them what they view as virtue. Teach them what they view as...
I feel like Nietzsche would still argue that that's them seeking their self-interest, but their self-interest is the aesthetic ideal.
He would probably argue that, yes. And I don't have a direct counter, except to say I don't think that that's everyone. It's just a perspective thing.
Yeah,
I don't think
sure.
that that's every preacher, every teacher, every nun.
And of course, I agree with that. But, you know, and this is something you even see in theology. You've seen this theological idea called Christian hedonism that tries to... almost take this Nietzschean idea, which is that everyone's going to be going after pleasure anyway. That thing that feels good, that thing that is in their self-interest, that brings them a sense of fulfillment. So
to play devil's advocate for Christian hedonism, though, that's so ironic. those words together.
There's so many layers to that sentence.
Yeah, good grief. I kind of just want to say that again. To play devil's advocate for Christian hedonism, I would say that Christian hedonism is making more of an observation that Christianity will bring the most pleasing life. It's making that observation. It's not saying seek the most pleasing life necessarily.
Let's go back to the beginning of the episode. If that's the case, maybe that's part of the reason why we see all this depression. Because people seek their self-interest on a societal scale.
Yeah.
Life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness.
That
takes
doesn't
us,
work.
Yeah, that takes us back to the essay. The essay was like, hey, these are our values, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
So observationally, if this is the society that we have, where we have a hard time naming people who would not exist if the maxim of Nietzsche were universally applied.
Yeah.
If we say all of that, and we see our society in our current state, observationally depressed, self-harming... I mean, we could go down a list of just absurdly terrible symptoms that people are experiencing and medicating.
Yeah.
Then we almost can conclusively say this is bad. This is a bad idea to employ.
Well, then that's why you see people like Jordan Peterson saying, you know, stop talking about rights, stop talking about this, and talk about responsibility. But that gets you into more of that authoritarian
It's a slightly different maxim, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now it's the common good. Now it's what can you do for your country?
I think this is an interesting tool that we might have stumbled upon here. Let's take maxims from different philosophers, apply Kant's categorical imperative to them, and wonder, if everyone followed those maxims, what would the society look like? That's sort of an interesting little tool we've stumbled upon.
Oh, yeah. That's interesting. I've actually never read Kant, and I've heard the categorical imperative mentioned, but I heard Nietzsche mention it. Mentioned the categorical imperative. And what's interesting is he feels that people are on their basal level not the same, so to apply the same things to everyone is off. And that's also what America seems to say. Everybody's, you know, part of the rainbow. The rainbow of diversity.
Yeah, I mean, but they also seek equity and equality and, you know,
it's a jumbled mess.
Outcomes.
It's just such a jumbled mess,
yeah.
You know?
There's a lot there.
Well, I like this categorical imperative tool. We might have to use this again.
Yeah,
and
sounds
see
interesting.
Happens.
You know, it's funny. I only took one philosophy class ever. It was in my undergrad. It was an ethics class.
And this is the one you learned.
And no, I remember everything from that class. We went over several theories of morality and all this stuff. It's just that class. It was at the very end of my undergraduate degree, and I remember thinking, "Man, I should have been a philosophy major. This is great. I remember everything. I didn't
it's
have
amazing.
To study."
Well, let's apply that then. Everyone seeks happiness because happiness is the terminus of all action.
Yeah.
We've already talked about that, and we agree that happiness wasn't.
And that
far
goes back to
there.
Very, very old theories, yeah.
Yeah, and almost even now, that's what everybody's doing, seeking their happiness in their own self-interest. And what's so funny is when you boil down these philosophies, there don't need to be that many of them.
Yeah, I was
it's
just
like
thinking
there could
that.
Be two or three.
I was like, even Peterson is maybe just a slight reformulation of Nietzsche.
Yeah.
And Nietzsche is maybe a slight reformulation of, you know, ancient Grecian theories. Like, I mean, everyone's seeking happiness.
Yeah.
I mean,
and, you know, Nietzsche would be totally okay with that. When he talks about his supermen, he describes them sometimes in classical terms.
Yeah.
Very Athenian or Spartan. He doesn't like Plato or Socrates, but
I just realized we're probably going to get a lot of oversimplification feedback if we get any feedback for this sort of stuff, because I've just equated Nietzsche and Peterson and Socrates, basically, and that's maybe not quite a good reflection of...
Maybe it's not, but also it's something to consider. Like, at what point do these thousands of philosophies people have come up with talk about the same things and come to the same conclusions, but use different words?
So if we... Okay, so the test, well, what happened here is basically we're looking at outcomes. We're looking at if a society were to actually apply the raw basic maxim that these philosophers produce, how different would these societies look? And what we're almost realizing in real time here is that they wouldn't look that different.
Yeah.
I mean, what is the difference between seeking one's own success and pleasure and growth and one's own happiness? Like, realistically, it's about the same set of actions that you're going to do in order to get to those
things. Yeah, you're just using a different word and, you know, maybe giving some different wings to the definition, but...
But then it's like, okay, so you oversimplified the philosophy because you got the wrong maxim. So maybe that's what we're doing. Maybe we are oversimplifying in terms of the maxims we're generating.
And that's the difficult thing, because you would, to be able to prove that we're doing that, you would have had to have read every book we've read and been present at every single one of these discussions, and this is talking to the audience.
Sure.
So I guess there's only one person listening right now that can maybe say, yeah, you're oversimplifying this, get wrecked. I.e. Stephen.
We're talking to you, Stephen. You feel special.
If he made it this far, he probably turned this off in like the first 20 minutes. It's like, wow.
He likes listening to our ramblings.
But yeah, so, I don't know, it's like, think of Ecclesiastes for a second.
Yeah.
If you believe that is the pinnacle of philosophy, which I kind of do, he makes it sound very simple. There's a few things. You can dedicate yourself to madness and folly.
Yeah.
You can dedicate yourself to testing the body with pleasure.
Right.
Or you can dedicate yourself to building great works. or to wisdom. So, you know, there's the kingly building of great works, the creative artistry, there's the hedonistic Epicurean, and imagine these as like boxes.
Yeah.
And now we click and drag Epicureanism, that goes in this box.
Yeah.
Stoicism, that goes in this box.
Connects the lines, right?
So we just have these little category boxes that we're just dropping philosophical schools into.
I mean, it hurts to think about it in these simple terms, but I'm having a hard time. Like, I can't really be devil's advocate against it either.
Because we've read this, we've really tried to think in their thoughts,
and this
and
is
we
why
keep arriving at the same conclusions.
This is why we're doing something different with the book club now, too. It's like, we've...
Redundancies.
We're done reading redundant things, you know?
Redundancies.
We'd like to create something now. We'd like to create these positive perspectives now.
Yeah. And that really brings us to the interesting thing. There's so many people doing this at the same time we are. And it's always the big names with lots of money. Like Hillsdale College is doing it. And their entire thing that they are starting with is like trying to rage against what we have come to the conclusion of. That everything is vain.
Yeah.
Essentially, that's what we've come to the conclusion of. Metaphysical novel approach, that's a proclamation of vanity. That's what that is. And they are saying, whenever you see the ads on YouTube, we're going to talk about truth. And he's sitting there in this, you know, smoky room with books behind him, his legs crossed.
Yeah.
Let's begin.
It's like those people who rage against relativism in general. I had a class recently where the professor asked, what was it exactly? It was like, is holiness relative? And one of the students was like, no, absolutely not. God is all holy. It's not relative. And he's like, really? What is God holy in relation to? And they answered immediately, oh, he's holy in relation to creation. So he used the word relation instead of relative, and he was perfectly fine with it. But when you use the word relative, the dude freaked out.
Then you say, what you say to that is he's incomparable. Like, there is no thing to compare God to
in
except
relation
within the Trinity.
To creation. Relative to creation, he is holy. And it was just like, people rage against this idea of relativism, among many other things. But anyways, that's kind of what that sounds like.
I guess in a sense it is relative, but... Okay.
It is. It is relative.
Yeah, because, you know, in relation to creation, but...
I mean, what the
also...
word means, it used to have a common meaning. It used to... I carried a pen around for a long time. I would only write personal letters with this pen. I literally carried it in my bag with all my other pens, but I wouldn't use it unless I was writing a personal letter. That was a holy pen. It was. It had a specific purpose, you know?
You could have responded to that guy's question, though. He's holy in relation to himself. Like, you compare him within the Trinity, and everything is perfect.
If we want to go to that philosophical, theological discussion, I actually do not think that holiness is applicable in the immanent Trinity.
I could see that. I mean, it's tough to really...
Which is weird because it's an attribute. It's actually a... what's the term for not being able to go to humans in... it is a attribute of God that's only for God in traditional theology. Humans cannot have holiness, and yet we are, you know, biblically speaking, we're called to be holy. We're commanded to be holy, really. And then you have the Israelite people who were set apart for a holy purpose unto God.
And in their relations, they're always relative to something, because the Philistines were not set apart.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's such a troll question.
It is.
Because it doesn't change anything.
Yeah.
The truth is still the truth.
This is a tangent.
No, this is good. This is good.
This is such
I'm
a
enjoying
tangent.
We're doing this.
Okay.
It's true that God is holy, right?
Yeah.
Saying that it's relative to something doesn't change. Like, this is what a professor does that's been there for 30 years. He's gotten bored and he's like,
that's true.
I want to go piss off some undergraduates.
Or in this case, master's level students.
Oh, man.
And it works. It really works. I had a professor once also say, you cannot know truth. And the dude in the back row was like, literally wrong. Yeah, I told you that story.
Okay, well, what
And
do
I'm
you
sitting
mean?
On the front row thinking like, he means metaphysical truth. I think he's right. And then I developed my formulation of metaphysical truth. And it's like, yeah, you can't actually know truth. Our brains are insufficient.
Oh, yeah, that's a biblical idea. I mean, we see through a glass but darkly. Now we know in part, but then I shall know in full. But we still know something.
We know something. Is it true? Is it truly true?
It's not fully true.
There you go. And that's what he meant. But anyways, these are troll professors.
He'll still say these troll... what I'm getting the vibe of your professors.
He's going to listen to this too. I'm going to tell him to listen to this podcast. And he's going to listen to however many episodes we've done and get here and know I'm talking about him. Anyways.
But, you know, okay, I'm not saying what he's saying is invalid. It's just like... It's literally a troll statement. Because
I think it's an important statement, though, isn't it? Like,
yeah, because you go back to Kierkegaard.
Yeah.
Kierkegaard is always talking about going beyond faith. And so many people want to go beyond faith. They want to not just have faith, but prove everything.
Right.
Like the Aquinas guy we've talked about.
Right.
You can't do that. Because then there's no reason for faith, and faith is the instrument God uses to save you.
Yeah, yeah. I used to have long thoughts about the relationship between faith and understanding and truth and, you know, what's in our heads and all that. And it's this weird thing where, you know, ultimately when it comes to the existential beyond, we work by faith. And now, in part, that's how I form my epistemology.
That's the next layer of thought I want to do. I want to do a philosophical exegesis of the word faith.
Yeah.
Because the definition listed in Hebrews, you know, that the writer of Hebrews proclaims and is like, ha ha, look, I define faith. It's like, great, what do I do? What does that even mean?
Yeah. How do I do faith?
Faith is the assurance of things hoped for and the evidence of things not seen, period. And you're like... Okay, well, what does this... How does this affect me?
I mean, I do take that definition as pretty much my working definition. Even in that paper of truth that I wrote, when I say, you know, I only believe things by faith, that's what I mean. It's assurance of things not seen. Even with the... in the case of this desk, I could say I have faith this desk exists.
Hmm.
I really believe this desk exists, you know? My knowledge has brought me up to a point. I act as if this desk exists based on knowledge, but I could also have faith and truly believe that it exists. It's not important
enough
to me.
So it's interesting to me
that
people replace the assurance of things not seen and try to replace it with assurance of things that they've
seen. Yes.
Ooh.
I don't even do things that are seen. I don't have assurance in things that are seen at this point.
I don't know if you're having this conversation with me right now. This is a dream.
This is so absurd. I hate talking at multiple levels of abstraction. People are going to think I'm loon.
Well, it'll also be entertaining. This is when the entertainment really begins.
Yeah.
Well, folks, we have kind of taken this to an interesting level, but I guess the only thing we can do here, going back to Nietzsche, is state... our manifesto.
Really? That's what we're going to do?
My manifesto is that truth cannot be known, but there are structures to reality which we can live in line with to varying degrees of success. And that is logos to me.
How is that a manifesto?
Because that affects what I do.
Oh, I suppose so.
I mean, that affects everything I do and I think.
Okay.
And the things that I choose to think and do about.
Okay, that's good. That's almost a building upon of my epistemology. That's really good.
So, you know, you might not be able to know truth, but still there is a structure that you can fit into. And
okay, what do you mean by structure exactly?
Remember what we talked about first couple episodes, logos.
Yeah.
And that structure might look like morality. You know, the matrix tends to zap you whenever you do things that... I don't know, that was a stupid statement. Making stupid statements now.
I'm listening. I will let you dig your grave.
Oh, man. I think we need that's really what I got at when I mentioned your novel metaphysical approach, is that there's the next layer of, okay, data is true. Data is always going to be filtered. So then that filtration can be done to differing levels of success.
Yeah.
So then that filtration... can fit in with logos or it cannot.
So The problem is finding that standard of success, finding that structure of logos. Because if we relate it back to anything here in this world, we're not on, we have a grounding problem, basically.
Yeah.
So if we relate it back to, you know, let's say, pleasure. Well, that's something physical, temporary, finite, something that you can't truly realize and know, in my sense. And so you have a grounding problem. So you almost do have to relate it back to either something really, really material and real, also in my sense, or you have to relate it to something that's beyond the existential beyond, or in the existential
beyond. The if-then-else statement, yeah.
Yeah. Because you really do need that structure to be an abstract metaphysical reality in order, and then it has to be something to build your life towards.
I think that if we combine your novel metaphysical approach,
yeah,
and the master narrative that I cannot unsee
could
everywhere
be.
I go,
could be.
If we combine those things, we might have ourselves a.
So what I was going to say, from kind of the theology student, you know, religious Christian perspective, is what we have in Genesis is the Imago Dei, made in the image of God. I think that that is the metaphysical reality, that quest that we're supposed to go down as humans, is to bear God's image here in creation, to point back and say, you know, just as we dominate over creation as humans, God dominates over all of creation. Point back to Him. And living according to, you know, God's very nature, as is very obvious in the New Testament, we're called to be holy as God is holy, perfect as God your Father is perfect, in different New Testament passages. That is living in accordance to the logo structure, because it's the Creator who defines that logo structure for creation. Now, this gets into the, at least in my head it does, it gets into the theoretical physics question of, could creation be any other way? My answer is no.
Hmm.
And increasingly, what we have from several individuals kind of at the cutting edge of theoretical physics is the answer is no. There's only one right way to do creation. There's only one correct way.
Hmm.
And that really does point to logos in my perspective. Because if you have a eternal being, you know, we don't know for sure because we do exist in this creation, but at the very least we'd say this creation could only be this way.
And it's like, is there more than one way to write a story?
Yeah.
Could you get rid of the master narrative structure and say, there was once a land of people where there were no problems? And they had no solutions because there were no problems, so they just existed. And they lived outside of time. And they're...
I mean, that's not a story.
Exactly.
That's nothing.
So you have to have the master narrative structure to make that even make
at
any
best,
sort of sense.
At best, I could see creation being different ways insofar as humans have free will. You know, humans may act differently than they do.
That's true.
By the definition of, you know, libertarian free will.
Yeah.
And that's about as far as I can go towards, you know, different forms of creation. Fundamentally, though, on a physics level, I don't see it.
There's no difference.
I don't think there can be.
So it's deterministic in the physical sense.
On a rules of physics sort of level.
Interesting.
Yeah. I've gone off on another tangent.
Well, no, this is all applied to Nietzsche, because what we've attempted to do is analyze what his society looks like. We agreed that it's something like the society we live in right now.
Yeah.
Kind of. We then use the categorical imperative as a heuristic to test it. And now we're like, okay, could we get something better? And the answer is something like, we would need a kingdom of people who live a specific way.
Yeah.
A specific set of ideals.
In your notes here, you have kind of a, in your Nietzsche notes, a proposed anti-logos is one of the things you wanted to maybe touch on. What did you mean by anti-logos? So we're talking about logos. How would Nietzsche's framework constitute an anti-logos?
By getting rid of all of these truth structures.
So he would completely reject our conception of logos and the right way to live according to that.
Yeah, and then, you know, but he still institutes a structure
right.
by claiming no structure. And that structure is what we've already mentioned. Everyone does what's right in their own eyes.
Yeah.
Everyone seeks their own self-interest. That in itself is a structure.
I see that, yeah.
But
it's just
broken down so far.
Okay, let's go back to the categorical imperative. Yeah. What is our maxim, or what is Logos's maxim? What is the maxim of Logos? Well,
maybe live beyond the now.
I was going to say, you know, live in according to the image of God, which is the same idea because he's beyond.
Yours is probably better because mine would be like, oh, well, I can be
Muslim,
more Christianese.
I can be
Hindu.
I don't know that it's better. It's more Christian-y. Both might work. Let's say if we had a society of individuals who only, or by their maxim, lived beyond the now, what would that look like?
I could still fly planes into World Trade Centers and wake up with 72 virgins, so...
Well, not really.
But we don't know. I'm kidding.
That's fine. There's issues with... the concept of an Allah creating creation as we see creation. He is truly beyond, he is truly far and distant.
I'm trying really hard to not be an open theist.
I could see that. When you're forming a maxim, it's difficult.
Let me see. I feel like we've already made that fall.
Okay, so I think this is a harder conversation than maybe I thought it would be.
No, this is
forming a maxim of Logos, because really, you're right. We do go immediately to an open theism question without a lot more layers of theology grounding us in the Judeo-Christian view, specifically the Christian view of a Trinitarian God. We're going to...
Live wisely.
We're going to fall off the boat without a lot more theology, I think.
Live wisely. Keep it as simple and narrow as possible. And... it's open enough and there's lots of definitions that need to happen underneath that broad.
I think it could be interpreted in really strange ways.
It can, but I think we're very much talking in the language of the natural man right now.
Yeah.
So the only thing I feel I can give is live wisely. And that's the thing, whenever we're doing philosophy, these theological terms mean something for us as we get on the same page.
Yeah.
But we're giving maxims to natural men, or at least that's been my assumption.
No, that's true.
Since we've done this, is that we're giving maxims to the natural person who has not been regenerate.
In that case, I think maybe live wisely is about as good as we can do.
And yet again, we've restated Socrates.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's just drag and drop this into one of our buckets.
Good. Well, that's all I had on my notes, and I feel like we have gotten this thoroughly back-asswards.
I have one more question from your notes.
This
will make it even worse.
This is good. I'm excited.
What in the world did you mean by metaphysical other world? The title for episode 17 on the list there, or maybe you might have numbers different.
Oh, yes.
I tried to figure out what you meant by this term. I have no idea. Metaphysical other world?
There is this idea in Nietzsche that he hates how everybody's pointing their actions at a future state.
Ah.
And he's like...
So he would hate the live wisely or live... Okay.
He probably would.
Which is somehow the conclusion we got to from the Nietzsche episode, but go on.
Yeah. That's good. So essentially, there's a world that is not physical. It's... below what we do here, and it's not here. It's in the future.
Yeah.
So, you know, a heaven or a hell, a state where we exist unphysically. He's like, I hate that you would choose to live for that when you could live for right now,
here and now.
And
okay.
Make yourself strong.
So in a way, we could definitely differentiate what we're claiming. I mean, it's the if-then-else. He basically hates the if-then-else formulation that we've talked about.
And we talked about that on one of the first couple episodes, and we tried to analyze his process of thought in the if-then-else. But just because Nietzsche hates that we use that heuristic to analyze him...
Doesn't make it a bad heuristic.
Doesn't make it a bad heuristic.
Yeah, absolutely.
Something that can't be done. It's not like he levels a broadside against it and destroys it. It's just that
he
speaks
like
against
it. Yeah, there's a difference. Okay, that makes sense then. I mean, in all genuineness, if there is this metaphysical other world that you're referring to, and it is eternal, you know, we go down the if then else statement again. It's like, it is more worthwhile to make the eternal state better for yourself than it is to make a finite temporary state better for yourself.
I think about that every day. Like, time is so relative in our experience.
Yeah.
It goes so quickly. Like, this year since my son was born,
you know, we're gonna move on in a real way from our actual lives
very quickly.
Yeah,
like, we're gonna be dead,
you know,
the
point of Christian hedonism is to say that in considering a worthwhile afterlife, you don't need to forget about the worthwhileness of the here and now.
Yeah,
sure, there might be persecution and suffering and hard times.
Oh yeah.
But in experiencing those things, you are actually enjoying a real human life.
And you're worshiping God
and worshiping thereby. So not only will your eternal state be wonderful, but your here and now will be worthwhile as well.
Yeah.
Which defeats hedonism, or defeats nihilism.
Absolutely.
You know, it gives you that purpose that nihilism doesn't have.
Absolutely. The problem comes when you begin to become such a pure Christian hedonist that you're enjoying all of these things God's given you. You're taking the Ecclesiastes verse, you're letting oil not be lacking on your head, and you're praising God maybe for these things. But then you're like, okay, what is there for me to do on here? And I've heard numerous answers. One answer I've heard is, this is the Great Commission. You are sent. But then, you know, there's verses that where Paul is speaking, and it sounds like, you know, pray that we can live in all simplicity and peace. You know, it's not like everybody that Paul is writing to and speaking of is going out and proclaiming from the rooftops with a tract in one hand and beating on a Bible in the other, the way we picture Billy Graham and like, oh, he's the good Christian.
Mm-hmm.
If we were all doing what we should do what Billy Graham is doing. So that's one answer. The other answer, and this is the answer I've really settled on for myself in recent days, is that treasure and keep and delight in the law of God.
Mm.
And it's as simple as that. And you can, that's not very simple. That's a supernatural thing.
Yeah.
To be able to keep the law of God. And because you can't, you have the blood atonement of Christ applied to your account. The substitutionary atonement and, or propitiation, whatever you want to call it. I think it's as simple as that. So, you know, when you think of these big visionary schematics, I'm going to change the world in this way, I've lost a lot of purpose in looking at those.
Wow.
I don't know. What other answers might there be to that particular question?
I mean, it kind of does depend on what you view as the most worthwhile spending of your time in the here and now in order to benefit your eternity. You know, that is the question. Like, how do you spend the time here and now in order to benefit eternity? I don't think that there's a very clear answer for that, even in the Christian sense. It's not very clear. Because what we are taught in the Christian sense is live according to your calling, live according to your gifts. You know, we have some specific commands, like meet together, meet with other Christians. Yeah. We have some specific things, but at the same time, from that big ethos, goal of life perspective, you have offered one option, I think is very valid.
Calling is, you know,
that could be a calling specific to you, is what I'm trying to say.
Well, there's a calling that is, let's break it down to terminology that is actually in the Bible. Calling is a word that we have backwards interpreted into things. Would we agree to that premise, at least?
I agree, yeah.
Okay.
I'm not a big fan of the idea of callings.
Let's take the judgment at the last day.
Yeah.
What will the judgment be based on? Well, we see the sheep and the goats being divided. The goats are lifted up, and Christ says to them, depart from me, you workers of iniquity. Another translation says, workers of lawlessness, doers of lawlessness.
Mm-hmm.
I never knew you. So those two things are connected. You do lawlessness, and you were never known. If you're in the position of the goat, which none of us want to be. If you're in the person of the sheep, Christ says to you, whenever you visited the sick or the infirm, you did this unto me.
Yeah.
So what I see again is just Christ applying the law of God to these people.
Right.
And that's the answer of Ecclesiastes. You get to the end, he says, the end of the matter. All has been said. Fear God and keep his commandments, for he shall bring everything into judgment. And then Christ takes that telescope that is looking afar off and zooms in on what that judgment in Ecclesiastes will look like.
Yeah.
And it's still on the basis of law.
Yeah. Fearing God being, in other places, the beginning of wisdom.
Yeah.
Which is, we said earlier, living wisely is perhaps the maximum we were proposing.
Yeah.
And if we do take that biblical sense of the definition, absolutely, that's the maximum we're proposing. Living wisely, fearing God being the beginning of that.
Yeah.
You know, if you fear God, then you're going to respect his commandments. You're going to live according to how he wants you to live. You're going to live according to the structure of Logos itself.
And that's a thing that happens as these things come into focus. Two things I want to see happen. We kind of, this has been our manifesto episode, it seems like. Two things. A love and delight in the law of God. And that's a lost art in Christendom, especially in America, because we have all these new theological pets that people have come up with. And you know, they're valuable. Like Christian hedonism is a valuable heuristic for looking at things. But there are people I know who dedicate their entire ministries to a concept of Christian hedonism. And then that's it. And it's not a biblical language. That's a very Greek term.
Absolutely.
So then we kind of begin to go astray in our thought because we're not using biblical categories to categorize these things.
If you take words as literal meaning.
Okay. No, it's... Words are data.
I just poked you, I'm sorry.
Words are data. So because words are data, we inherently form ourselves in these systems of thought connected to the words. I think we're saying the same thing. But you see where I'm going with this? Is those are the two things I want to see happen. Delight in the law of God. And the second thing is when you begin delighting in the law of God, you see your need for Christ. It's impossible to not... if it's being done correctly, and if God's given us eyes to see how simple it is that Christ is the antidote to our chaos. To little get a little Petersonian reference.
Yep, I immediately saw that.
And that's what it is. You know, the Übermensch longs for Christ.
Yeah.
The philosopher king longs for Christ. The entire Hebrew scripture longs for Christ.
They definitely need him.
Yeah.
Whether they recognize him or not.
You know, like, all of these philosophies point towards, I think, what we're saying right now. Keep the laws. Delight in them. And then realize that you are not going to do that very well. And you will always need Christ. Then, you know, you get into this question of maybe we can do it perfectly. Maybe you're of the perspective of the Methodist homeboy. What's his name?
I don't know who you're talking about.
Not John Newton. That's another guy. Charles Wesley.
Oh, okay. The actual...
They held to the idea that you could be perfect while you were here.
I've met some teachers like that in the modern day, actually.
And it's so funny to me because 1 John strikes that down right away. If any man says he has no sin, he is deceiving himself.
I quoted that verse to someone who was preaching that he was perfect. And he quoted it back to me. And I was like, what? Of course I'm sinful. What are you? What? He's like, you're in error right now. And I'm like,
so are you.
Okay. Does that change the verse's meaning? It literally, the crowd there, actually, it was on campus. Anyways.
And see... That's the thing that is just so interesting to me. It's like, you can't even understand the commandments of God without the Holy Spirit. And we hope we have the Holy Spirit. Paul seems to assume that you can know whether you have the Holy Spirit and know if other people have the Holy Spirit by inspecting, you know, I'm not going to use that though, because that's not a biblical term. But we can observe fruit.
Yeah. There's a lot to talk about there.
And this might be another episode.
I think for the purpose of discussing Nietzsche, the purpose of discussing the alternative maxims, the alternative manifesto that we perhaps are proposing for life.
Yeah, folks, so sorry to smack you in the face with Jesus, but That's the way it is. And thank you for thinking these thoughts with us, and we hope that you will get to the same conclusion as us.
Because that's the way it is. Thanks, guys.